I need to say something real quick before you. Okay. All right. Today is July 9th, 2010, at the Shippensburg Bible School. This is the third period class. Brother Michael Ashton. His theme for the week is David's Mighty Men, and his topic for today is Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada. And after this class,
I think it's Joab the politician.
Joab the politician. The topic for this morning is Joab the politician. After this class ends, after the closing prayer, please stay seated for a few announcements. Brother Michael.
Thank you. Cool, you can go hot and cold quite quickly when you think it's a different subject from the one that you planned you were going to give. We're going to think about Joab today. We've already thought of the sons of Zeruiah, and Joab was one of them. Do you remember when we looked at their names, we worked out the order of their birth? So let's just check that you're still awake and that you remember what we spoke about before. Who was Zeruiah? David's sister, right? Three sons. Can you remember the names of her three sons? Asahel is one, thank you. Joab's another. And Abishai, thank you. And the order of their birth, according to 1 Chronicles chapter 2, is Abishai is the eldest, Joab is the middle son, and Asahel is the youngest son. Now that's confirmed in one sort of way, because in the book of 1 Samuel we find Abishai being mentioned and doing things, and Joab is hardly mentioned at all. There's only one reference to Joab in 1 Samuel. If you just look at 1 Samuel chapter 26, where David is talking to Ahimelech, who's a Hittite man. 1 Samuel 26, verse 6. Then answered David and said to Ahimelech the Hittite, and to Abishai, son of Zeruiah, brother to Joab. So that's the only place that Joab is mentioned in the first book of Samuel, and he's mentioned as being Abishai's brother. He's mentioned in that particular way because subsequently Joab becomes the better known of the three brothers. The best known of the three brothers. But that's just the way he's referred to there. So to find the first proper mention of Joab, we need to turn over into 2 Samuel and chapter 2. And what we're going to do together this morning is to look at the incidents of Joab's life. Now, I've given the game away to some extent and told you what my conclusion is by the title of today's session. But I want you just to look at what Joab did and the way in which he acted, and see what you think of his character. Think of the things about it that are good, any things about it that are bad. And in the process, compare Joab with David. Because we know about David that he was a man after God's own heart. So there is certainly a good person to follow, to have as an example for us to live our lives. And what we want to ask ourselves is, well, what about Joab? Is there anything in Joab's life that's good for us to follow? Anything in Joab's life that's bad? And we ought not to follow. Okay? So we're just going to look at the incidents in which Joab is involved and just try and draw out those things if we can. And I'll be throwing out some questions and just to see what you think about it as we go through. So 2 Samuel 2 is the first time that Joab is mentioned. And we looked at this the other day. Do you remember when Abner, who is the captain over Saul's men, Saul and Jonathan now having died, when Abner and his men are facing Joab and David's men, and they meet either side of the pool. This is where Joab is. But it's the first mention of him, and he's already a captain. He is the leading figure in this particular incident. Now, we don't know how old Joab was, but if he was too young to have a proper mention in the book of 1 Samuel, then he is quite young. It's possible that he's just a teenager, or perhaps only just 20 at this point, and yet he's a commander. Now that tells us something about Joab, doesn't it? What do you think it tells us about him? Well, he's obviously capable, isn't he? Anything else? A good leader. What do soldiers do? fight. So do you think he was any good at fighting? Yes. Well, he was commander, so it's quite probable, isn't it? So we've got, he's capable, he's a good leader, probably a good fighter, perhaps quite strong. And that's possible, isn't it? You tend not to get weaklings as soldiers, certainly not getting up to commander level. So we're already beginning to build up a bit of a picture in our mind. Here's Joab as a young man, this is the first mention of him, and he's already in that position. I mean, there are terms that we would use to describe someone like that in the world. Now, whether these terms are only ones that we use in the UK and you don't use them over here, I don't know. But have you heard of a high flyer, a go-getter? You know, all of those things are the sort of person that Joab may well have been to be in this position so early in his life. So you begin to build up a picture in your mind of Joab. We can't see his face, but the sort of character that he is. When you compare him in this incident with Abner, Abner seems to have much more common sense than Joab does. Joab is the young, enthusiastic, gung-ho commander of the forces. Abner is older and wiser, grey-haired, been there, done it, seen these things before, a little bit more careful, a little bit more measured about the things that he does. So you're already seeing a difference between Joab and Abner. And it's in immediately following this incident that Joab's youngest brother Asahel dies. Remember when Abner hits him with the butt end of his spear. So Asahel dies, and we know the effect that that's going to have on a man like Joab. Just look at verse 22. Again, we read it the other day, but now from the lips of Abner, this wise old commander of Saul's army, we get another little factor about Joab. Abner says to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I smite you to the ground? How could I hold up my face to Joab, thy brother?" So Joab, it seems, is a sort of individual that inspires fear in the hearts of others. Even Abner is a little bit frightened of Joab. Now, if you think about how other people view you, which would you prefer? Would you prefer to instill fear in other people, or would you wish them to be instilled with love because of what you're doing? I think we'd prefer the second, wouldn't we? We don't want people to be frightened of us, to be afraid of us, do we? But it seems as if that's how Joab was. People were a little bit frightened of him, a bit afraid. So let's turn over the page, come to chapter 3. Now, chapter 3 starts by saying there's a long war between the men of Saul's house and the men of David. But David is getting stronger and stronger, and Saul's men are getting weaker and weaker. So all you've got to do, really, to resolve this problem is just to give it time, isn't it? In the end, the men of Saul will get so weak that they just disappear off the scene, and David will get stronger and stronger, and everything will be David's. And Abner, this wise man, was able to see that happening, and he thought, I don't want that to happen. I spent all my time with Saul and Saul's men. The best thing to do is to capitulate now, throw our lot in with David, see if we can cut a deal with David so that at least we get some position while David is king, rather than just disappear into ignominy. And so that's what Abner does. And Abner decides he's going to go to David and make an offer. Verse 12. Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, "Whose is the land? Make your league with me, and my hand will be with you to bring about all Israel unto you." Why just wait, David, for these things to happen? It could happen now. If you're prepared to shake on it with me, look, just I've got my hand out, just shake on it, then I will deliver all of Saul's men to you, and you'll have all Israel. That's what you want, isn't it? They can all come now. Just make a deal. And interestingly, notice David's response. David says, "I will make a deal with you. I've just got one condition to this deal, and that is that Saul's daughter, who became my wife for a time, Michal, Saul's daughter has got to come. And so that's what happens. And Abner's master, Saul's son Ishbosheth, sends, verse 15, and takes Michal from the person to whom she's been married, because she'd been taken away from David, from this man Phaltiel, son of Laish. And it's a very pathetic picture in verse 16. Her husband goes with her, weeping along behind her to Bahurim. And Abner says, go away. You know, like, kick him away like a stray dog. And the man goes back. And Michal comes and is reunited with David. That's what's going to happen. So this offer of a league between the men of Saul and the men of David appears to have been sealed. The only problem is what has happened with David. Look at verse 20. Abner came to David to Hebron with just 20 men. That's quite risky if you think about it. David and all his troops are in Hebron. Abner's got more men than 20, and he's just come with 20. It's part of the deal. He's saying, look, this isn't a warlike exploit. I'm not coming with a great force of men. If you want, you could suddenly put us all in handcuffs because you've got more men than we've got. But I'm coming to treat for peace with you. So he comes with just 20 men. And he's going to leave, verse 21, to gather all Israel to David the king to make a league with him, and that he can reign over all the people, just as he wants to. And David sends Abner away, and he goes away in peace. No sooner is the door closed behind Abner, verse 22, the servants of David and Joab came from pursuing a troop, bringing a great spoil with them. So Joab's been out fighting enemies while all this is happening. Abner has come to Hebron to see David, and Joab isn't there. And Joab learns as soon as he comes back what's happened, that David has entered into this league with Abner. Look at it, verse 23. When Joab and all the army with him had come, they told Joab, saying, Abner son of Ner came to the king, he's sent him away and he's gone in peace. And Joab comes to the king and says, what have you done? Abner came to you. Why is it that you've sent him away and he's quite gone? Now, I want you to read through again that verse 24 for yourselves. And having read it, I want us to be able to list out some of the problems that we find in that verse. Some of the things that we learn about Joab from the way in which he speaks. Just read that verse 24. Ask yourself, first of all, who is he speaking to? Who's he speaking to? David. What is David at this time? He's a king, right? Now look at the verse and ask yourself, do you think that's the way a subject, however high up in the land he may be, the way a subject should talk to a king? And does it sound like it? Can you find any hint of reverence or respect in that verse? Is there any word that gives you an indication that he's got respect for David? In fact, if we didn't know the situation, if we just took that verse completely out and read it on its own, who would you think was the superior and who was the inferior? I mean, it sounds as if Joab is the superior and David isn't it. What do you think you're doing? It sounds like a parent talking to a child, doesn't it? Rather than the subject talking to a king. It doesn't even sound like a nephew talking to an uncle. Does it? Which is what it really was. Joab was David's nephew. But do you talk to your uncles like that? I hope you don't. So almost the first words that we hear from Joab to David, and this is the way in which he's speaking. What have you done? Abner came to you today. Why have you sent him away? And he's quite gone. You know Abner, son of Ner, goes on to say in verse 25. He came to deceive you, to know you're going out and coming in. Those 20 men he brought with him were spies. All they were doing was just trying to seek out, discover all the weakness in your defences. And the next thing we know is the whole troop is going to come and we're going to be destroyed. I mean, is Joab paranoid or what? And that's the way it sounds, isn't it? What do you think Job's real problem is here? Anyone like to make a guess what the real problem is? What he thinks might happen, sorry? He's worried about Abner. Yes, you see, Abner was the captain of Saul's army. And David has got to have a captain of his army. At this point, we haven't yet discovered this, so let me just tell you. At this point, David has not chosen a captain for his army. If there's any captain at all, it's David. But David's now king. And the king, although commander-in-chief, you know, just like Barack Obama is commander-in-chief of all the armed forces of the USA, doesn't actually go out on the battlefield, does he? You know, he's not so foolish as to do that. So kings don't do that. So you need a commander of your army, and David has not yet appointed a commander of the army. Who do you think wants that job? Joab wants the job. And he sees a threat, a potential threat in Abner, because Abner's older, more experienced, wiser, may actually be stronger, may be a better tactician. I mean, all of those things, but Joab wants that job. Joab wants to be commander of David's forces. So he's envious. That's the point. He's envious of Abner. Now, carry on reading. Joab goes out from David, verse 26, sends messengers after Abner, who brought him again. He got as far as the well of Sirah, and David didn't know it. Now that's incredible, isn't it? Joab leaves David, now takes matters into his own hand, sends messengers to Abner to call him back. And I've got no doubt at all, the record doesn't tell us, but I've got no doubt at all that Joab uses David's name as a way of getting Abner to come back. The king wants to see you again. There's something he forgot to tell you about. So come back. And when Abner does come back, Joab is there. Notice where Joab is in verse 27. Can you see? Where is Joab? In Hebron? Who can find it? In the gate. All right? If you want to be the first person to meet someone coming into the city, where would you be? At the gate. So he wants to be sure that he sees Abner before Abner sees David. So as soon as Abner arrives at the city, Joab takes him aside and talks to him quietly. Just takes him away, just to a corner. I've got something that I need to say to you, and I need to say to you privately. And no sooner does he get him there than, well, he kills him. That's what verse 27 says. Smote him there under the fifth rib, and he died. And he killed him because Abner had killed Asahel. See, Asahel was right in the previous chapter. How was I going to face Joab if I have to do anything to you, Asahel? Well, now here he is, face to face with Joab, and Joab doesn't give him a second chance, kills him on the spot, and he's dead. Now, notice David's reaction, verse 28. When David heard it, he said, I and my kingdom are guiltless before the Lord forever for the blood of Abner, son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Joab and on all his father's house. Let there not fail from the house of Joab one that has an issue or a leper or leans on a staff or falls on the sword or lacks bread. And then we're told something else in verse 30. It wasn't just Joab. So Joab and Abishai his brother slew Abner because he'd slain their brother Asahel at Gibeon in the battle. So this was a plot between Joab and his older brother Abishai to wreak vengeance on Abner because Abner had slain their brother Asahel. They cooked it up between them. It wasn't that just Joab was in the gate, but in this shadow beside the gate where Joab drew Abner when he came in, Abishai was there. Just in case Joab wasn't able to kill him, then Abishai will be able to. Probably Abishai held Abner's arms while Joab thrust in the sword. You see, these are men that hold a grudge, Joab and Abishai. And David's response is to tell Joab and all the people to mourn for Abner. To mourn for Abner. We're told in verse 33, the king lamented Abner. Did Abner die as a fool dies? Well, he did, unfortunately. Now, let's just think about this carefully, this incident, because it's a very important one. It's the first real conflict that we have between Joab and David. What do you think David should have done in this situation? Was it right that Joab killed Abner? No, it wasn't. I mean, Asahel was killed in battle, wasn't he, in the heat of battle. And things do happen in battle, and in a sense, different rules apply in battle from outside battle. Abner wasn't killed in battle. And this was sneaky. This was skullduggery to get him back into the camp, get him back into the city in that way, and then just pretend you're going to talk to him and thrust him through with a blade. What should David have done? I mean, at the very least, he should have told Joab off. I mean, he should have sent Joab away. And probably even brought him before the courts. He's murdered a man. This is murder. And under the law, if you take a man's life, you die. Didn't apply it when you were at war. And it may be that David said, well, you know, at the moment, this league into which we entered hasn't properly been finalised, so perhaps we are still at war with these people, and therefore it's not legally murder. No, perhaps that was the reason. But why do you think David didn't do any more with Joab than he did? Can you think of any possible reasons? Number one, the relationship. What was their relationship? Uncle and nephew. So there's a possible reason, isn't there? Why was it that Abner told Asahel not to run behind him? Because he was frightened of killing him because of Joab. Do you think David's frightened of Joab? I mean, it sounds a little bit like it, doesn't it? Not only because he's his nephew, but there's a little bit of fear there in David for Joab, I think. And there's a third reason, which is perhaps the most important of them all, and that is David's an incredibly compassionate man. I know on the one occasion that we were thinking of yesterday, it was different. But he's a very compassionate man. And he's compassionate here as well, it seems, to Joab. To his own hurt and to the hurt of Israel, as we shall discover as we go on. Right, come to 2 Samuel 5. Now, as I said to you, the leader of David's army has not yet been chosen. Now, the strange thing about 2 Samuel 5 is that despite the fact that much of the land has been settled by the children of Israel over very many years, there's one city here that's not yet been settled by Jews. Or if it has been settled, and I think it was back in the days of Joshua, it's gone back into Canaanite hands. And that's the city of Jerusalem. It's really a surprise when we come to 2 Samuel 5 that Jews aren't living in Jerusalem, but they're not. The people who are living in Jerusalem are Jebusites, and the city isn't called Jerusalem at this stage, it's called Jebus. So this is what David is going to do. Now he's king over all Israel. So verse 6, the king and his men went to Jerusalem to the Jebusites who inhabited that land, and they speak to David saying, we've got an impregnable city, there's no way you can enter into this city, we can guard this city with just blind and lame watchmen. It was a taunt to David. Now, David is going to throw out a challenge to his men, because David knows that there is one weak spot in the city. And that weak spot is its water supply. Every city needs a water supply, otherwise the people are going to die. If you've got a city with no water supply, then an army can just come and surround the city and just sit there, folding its arms and say, I'm going to wait here until they all are so thirsty that they're going to come out begging for help. I don't even have to get my sword out of its scabbard. They'll come asking me for help soon. But Israel had got access, sorry, the Jebusites had got access to water in their city. And what they'd done is they dug a shaft down, because right underneath Jerusalem there was a spring. And you can go to Jerusalem today and find this. And that shaft is there. It's called Warren's Shaft. And David knew that if you could possibly get in at the bottom end of this shaft where the spring was, and if you're a nimble and agile individual, fearless as well. You could climb up that shaft, which meant that you had to stick your weapon in your belt, and there you were with your elbows and your knees against the edge of the shaft, climbing up this shaft all the way till your head pops out at the top, hoping there's no one there ready to cut it off. If you're prepared to do that, you could get into the city, open the gates, and make a way for your countrymen to come in and help take the city. That was the only way that you could get into the city. And so David says, we need a champion. We need someone who's prepared to do that. Who's prepared to climb the water shaft? And in order to make it worth someone's while, he says, the first man up the shaft I will make commander of my army. Well, you couldn't see Joab for dust. I mean, that's where he wanted to be. He was straight up that shaft like no one's business. There were probably people who could have done it quicker than him, but there was no way they were going to beat Joab. Joab was the first one up that shaft, and David had then, because he was a faithful, truthful man, David, has to make him ruler over the people. Now, I've just got a little theory. Let's just try this one out for size. We've already seen David and Joab, and if I'm right, and you know, disagree with me, but put forward evidence for your disagreement. If I'm right, there's a little bit of fear that David has about Joab. And David has got to appoint someone to be captain over his army. So what's he going to do? Who's he going to appoint as captain? So what he does now is, instead of saying, I'm going to appoint this other man captain, he says, whoever it is that gets there first will be captain, hoping that Joab won't be first. He's prepared to accept anybody else but Joab. But unfortunately, Joab is the first one there, and David has to make him captain of his forces. So by the time you come to chapter 8, come to 2 Samuel 8, verse 15, David reigned over all Israel, he executed judgment and justice to all his people, and Joab, son of Zeruiah, was over the army. So David's true to his word, he's made Joab captain. So what's Joab going to be like, do you think, as captain over David's army? Let's just come on to chapter 10. Notice how chapter 10 starts. Came to pass, the king of the children of Ammon died. His son reigned in his stead, and David said, I'm going to show kindness to this new king because his father showed kindness to me. Now, we don't know what the incident was where the former king of Ammon showed kindness to David, although it was probably when David was on the run. Do you remember when David was on the run from Saul? He had to send his parents away. He sent them into Moab to be looked after, and it may be that they had to pass through Ammonite territory, and the king of Ammon allowed them to do that. Didn't see them as a threat at all, and graciously allowed that to happen. That may have been the act of kindness that the king of Ammon showed towards David. And David says, now he's died and his son is there, I'm going to show that there's no ill feeling between me and the Ammonites. So I'm going to send these men to the king of Ammon, the new king of Ammon, saying, look, let's be friends. We don't need to fight against each other. You're where you are and I'm where I am. And let's not disturb each other. Let's just live side by side in peace. But the new king of Ammon, fresh, brash, new king, sees these men come from David. And by this time, the kingdom of David is well established. The news about the kingdom has gone out. It's prosperous. And he sees these men from David as a threat. And so he decides to send them back humiliated. And they're humiliated by having their beard cut off in the middle. So there's one half of the face is shaved and the other half is left with a beard on. They'd look a bit odd, wouldn't they? And then he cuts off their clothes right at the middle so that they're naked from that point downwards and sends them back. Haven't got anything else that they can wear. And as soon as that's learned by David, verse 5, he goes to meet them because the men are ashamed. And the king says, well, don't come back into the city. Don't come back to Jerusalem at the moment. Just stay in Jericho. You'll be able to get new clothes there. If you wait a while, your beards will grow and you can come back and no one will know anything about it. So David is trying to keep it quiet. But the Ammonites, who have sent these men back, realize that they're foolish, and so they hire people from Syria. You see that in verse 6. They hire Syrians, 20,000 footmen, and 1,000 men from Maacah, and 12,000 men from Ishtob, and they're going to come and make war against David. So David has to now to marshal his forces. He wasn't going to make a big issue of this, but he now has to. And he sends Joab and all his army of the mighty men. Now, how do you think Joab is going to deal with this? What's he going to do? Well, Joab, in effect, is now acting as David's hitman, isn't he? He's going to go in hard. And that's what he does. He goes against the children of Ammon and against the other men that they brought with them. And there's no quarter given. Those men are destroyed. Now, let's just try and think, if we can, what we've learned about Joab and what we know about David. Now, if David cared for anything at all, he cared for Israel because they were God's people. Now, do we think Joab cared for Israel? Do you think he did in any way? Well, I think he did. Because he was an Israelite. But that was the reason he cared for them. They're his people, and he wanted Israel to be prosperous and a great nation. The one name that we don't really hear from Joab's lips is the name of God. We don't hear him talking in any spiritual way at all. So David was keen about Israel and wanted a strong Israel, and so did Joab want a strong Israel. David was a forceful leader of men, by example. Well, so was Joab. That's exactly what Joab was. Very forceful leader of men, by example. So, to all outward in purposes, these two men look identical, uncle and nephew. But there are attributes that David has got that Joab hasn't got. Joab would never have done what David did at the beginning of 2 Samuel 10. To show kindness to an enemy country. Would never have crossed his mind. David is always outward looking, always concerned about other nationalities, always concerned about the underprivileged. And he was prepared to help them. Joab wasn't concerned about them at all. The characteristic that Joab most admired was strength and power and might. That wasn't the things that David was seeking after. And so as we see these two men now living out their lives, then we find Joab grasping after strength all the while. He wants to be stronger and stronger. He becomes so capable, turn over to the next chapter, 2 chapter 11, that David can send Joab out and not bother at all. He knows that Israel's affairs are going to be well looked after in Joab's hands because Joab's got his own personal ambition, which he's harnessed to a national ambition. And Joab won't let go until he's accomplished it. So David can remain in Jerusalem while the army goes out on its business. And there's a sense in which it's the strength of Joab that brings about David's downfall with Bathsheba. Because if he'd not got such a strong commander to his army, then David would have been out with his army and he wouldn't have been in his palace and he wouldn't have seen Bathsheba bathing. And he wouldn't have gone and lain with her, and she wouldn't have become pregnant, and he wouldn't have needed to call Uriah, and he wouldn't have had to send Uriah back to the battle, and Uriah wouldn't have died. And that's the problem, isn't it? Once you make a wrong decision, it just multiplies and multiplies and multiplies, until in the end you think, how on earth did I get here? And it was right back there, with the wrong decision you took right at the beginning. So here's Joab growing stronger and stronger, and as he gets stronger and stronger, he is making David weaker. David, who is a strong man in his own right. And the worst thing is, this is the turning point, 2 Samuel 11, because have you forgotten the letter? Never forget the letter. You remember the letter that David wrote about Uriah? Gave to Uriah, said, you carry it, put it in your pocket, take it, go to Joab and give it to Joab. Where do you think that letter is now? Where do you think it is? Do you think when Joab got it and read it, he said, oh yes, now I can do what David says. I'll now tear it up and throw it on the fire. Do you think that's what he did? Oh no. It was his most precious possession, that letter. He never knew when he might have to use it, because it would explain what David had done and what David had asked Joab to do. And from this point onwards, the commander, the leader, is not David, who it should have been, but Joab, who it shouldn't have been. And Joab has got a hold on David. You see, when it comes to chapter 13 and the incident between Amnon and Tamar, then all of David's fears are revived. Amnon behaves like David behaved with Bathsheba, only much, much worse. It's a dreadful thing that Amnon did with Tamar. It's just like a caricature of his father David. And Absalom takes matters into his own hands, and David does nothing about it. Just like earlier he'd done nothing about Joab killing Abner, so now he does nothing about Absalom killing Amnon. He hasn't learned the lesson, has he? And Joab is seeing all this happening, and he now knows that he's got another one within David's household who he can manipulate, and that's Absalom. And he does manipulate Absalom to his own ends, continues to do it. I mean, the classic example with Joab is this. It's the bringing back of Absalom out of exile to David. It's 2 Samuel chapter 14. It's the incident of the wise woman of Tekoa. Just look at this and notice what it is that Joab does. Verse 2 of 2 Samuel 14, Joab sends to Tekoa, fetches a wise woman, says, pretend to be a mourner, put on clothes of mourning, anoint yourself with oil. Look as if you're a woman who's been mourning for a long time. And then come to the king, and these are the words you're to say to the king. Now, why do you think Joab has done that? And the reason is, he knows David better than we know David. What are David's weak points? Weak point number one is women. All right? Now we know that. David had an eye for a pretty woman. So, does Joab choose a man to go and give a message to David? No, he chooses a woman. And David likes wise women. Remember how fond he was of Abigail. Remember Abigail? Wife of Nabal? And David and Abigail were just like that together, because she got a mind that was attractive to David, as well as a face and body that were attractive to David. So here's this wise woman of Tekoa who comes. So Joab knows David, he knows he likes women, he knows he likes wise women, so that's what he's chosen. She's been mourning for years, this woman, and she comes with a sob story. Well, that's exactly how David is. Remember, after his sin, when Nathan goes in and tells the little parable about the man with the poor little ewe lamb, David's in tears before the parable's finished. He's such a compassionate man. And Joab knows that, and he plays on David's compassion. As a result of which, David brings Absalom back into Jerusalem. And what does Absalom do when he comes back into Jerusalem? Well, he begins to foment rebellion within the city, taking people aside, whispering them in the gate, saying to them, if I were king, I would be able to grant you all that you need. Pity my father's still on the throne. Just wait till I'm king. And he says it to them all, until in the end, there's such a disturbance in Jerusalem that when Absalom finally decides to act, David has to leave with his tail between his legs. And it was Joab that was instrumental in bringing Absalom back. You see, he got everything going for him that could have been good. He got characteristics that were exactly the same as David's on the outside, but he hadn't got the characteristics that David had got on the inside. They weren't there at all. And remember, when Samuel was sent to choose David, God said to Samuel distinctly, don't look on the outward appearance, but look on the heart, because it's the heart that's important. And of course, in the end, that was Joab's problem. The problem was with his heart. Well, we can't look at all the other things in Joab's life. We've looked at the most important ones. Just come to 1 Kings chapter 1. Just going to look at a couple of verses now. 1 Kings chapter 1, 1 Kings chapter 2, before we finish. 1 Kings 1 and verse 7. This is now Adonijah. Absalom has died. The next son of David to rebel against him is Adonijah. Adonijah is going to become king, so he thinks. He confers, verse 7, with Joab, son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar the priest, and they, following Adonijah, helped him. So Joab decides, well, David's an old man. I mean, he's hardly alive now. He's not going to last much longer. I need to find out who the new king is going to be. I must now ingratiate myself with this new king. It's surely going to be an Adonijah. I'll throw in my lot with him. What a fool. Because it wasn't to be. And Solomon, the youngest of David's sons, Solomon, the son of Bathsheba, is the one whom David selects. David sends out the command to anoint Solomon as king. The noise of the rejoicing at the coronation of Solomon disturbs the party that Adonijah and the others are having to celebrate Adonijah being enthroned as king, and they creep back to Jerusalem, wondering what's going to happen to them. And Joab realizes that if Solomon comes to the throne, he's going to do what David, his father, would be not prepared to do to Joab. And so Joab runs into Jerusalem to where the altar is and grasps hold of the horns of the altar. There it is. Come to chapter 2, verse 28. This news came to Joab, for Joab had turned after Adonijah, though he didn't turn after Absalom. And Joab fled to the tabernacle of the Lord and caught hold on the horns of the altar. And it was told King Solomon, Joab was fled to the tabernacle of the Lord. Behold, he's by the altar. And Solomon sends to Benaiah, one of the mighty men. We're going to look at Benaiah tomorrow. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, go fall upon him. Benaiah came to the tabernacle of the Lord and said, thus said the king, come forth. He said, no, I'll die here. And Benaiah wants to check. That's really what Solomon wants him to do. So he goes back to Solomon. Do you really want me to kill him? He's by the altar. And Solomon said, yes, slay him. And so he comes. Do as he has said, fall upon him, bury him, take away the innocent blood Joab shed from me and from the house of my father. He killed two men more righteous and better than he, Abner the son of Ner and Amasa son of Jetha, captain of the host of Judah. We didn't have a chance to look at that incident. The blood return on the head of Joab and on his seed forever, but not on David, upon his seed or on his house. Upon them there shall be peace forever from the Lord. So Benaiah son of Jehoiada went up, fell upon him and slew him, and he was buried in his own house, in the wilderness. It's a fitting end for Joab, wasn't it? To be buried in a nowhere place, just in the wilderness, as if the spot was unmarked, the end of Joab. Because despite all his good qualities, there was only one person Joab was concerned about, and that was himself, number one. Not prepared to think about others. And that's why I call Joab a politician. Because that's how they are, isn't it? Okay, thanks very much for listening.